these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that upon these are love, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
I think my talk is advertised as The Myth of the Good War. I had another title for this talk, which is similar, Three Holy Wars. There are three wars in American history which are untouchable, uncriticizable. You ever hear anybody say anything bad about the Revolutionary War? No. The British, maybe. Nobody criticized the Revolutionary War. It's very obvious. It's a war for independence against England. Any of you know how many soldiers died in the Revolutionary War? I would guess that not too many people know, because it's never talked about. And because people assume it's an insignificant number, right? You know, there was the Battle of Bunker Hill, there was Valley Forge, there was the Battle of San. But you know, it's no big deal. There's no point paying attention that we won the war, we got independence from England. 25,000 casualties. There may have been 50,000, but you probably know by now that casualty figures in war are very crude. Nobody really knows. There'll be disagreements up to a million. I'm serious. People, how many people died in Vietnam? Oh, I think 2 million. Or maybe 3 million. We're not sure. Really? Imagine not being sure. A million people just being, yeah, people don't know. 25,000, well, 25,000 is not much, right? 25,000, what's 25,000 lives if you win independence against England? 25,000 is less than half of the number of men who were soldiers who were killed in Vietnam. But wait a while. What was our population then? It was about 3 million. If you extrapolate, what would 25,000 dead mean in relation to the present population? Be 2.5 million. 2.5 million dead. So that if you want to say we are winning independence against England today, right? Let's pretend that today we have been subservient to England and we want to win independence, instead of, as is true, England is subservient to us and wants to win independence, you see. Would you be willing to sacrifice 2.5 million? Would you accept that 2.5 million people as a cost for gaining independence? Might you not say, well, hey, we do want independence, but is there another way? Another way we can do this without fighting a war that costs the lives of 2.5 million people? So there, on that side of the ledger, you have to put the human cost of war in every one of these good wars, and only then, and acknowledging the good side, but then at least you have an honest balance sheet. Not a distorted balance, not a one-sided balance sheet, an honest balance sheet, and then you can make a judgment. If you decide, oh yeah, it would be worth 2.5 million to win independence from it, okay. You can make that judgment if you want, especially if none of those 2.5 million are related to you. But what about other factors? Another question is generally not asked about good wars. Good wars are generally based on a single criterion of something good that was won. And there are other things, peripheral issues, other issues, side issues, or they seem like side issues, that usually aren't examined. By that I mean is, okay, the colonists win independence from England. There's an interesting question. Who gains from victory in a war? Now, governments that fight wars, because it's governments that initiate wars and governments that fight wars, governments would like us to believe that all of us gain from a war. But that's not necessarily true. There are people who gain, and there are other people who don't gain. Did black slaves gain from the Revolutionary War? Slavery before the war, slavery after the war. Did the new government ushered in by the Constitution do away with slavery? No, it legitimized slavery. In fact, it declared slaves as three-fifths of a person, diminished the humanness of slaves. In fact, blacks did not rush. You would think if the Revolutionary War had anything to do with not just winning independence from England, but winning liberation for black people, they would have rushed to the colors, fought for their own. No, they didn't rush at all. Washington did not want blacks in the Revolutionary Army. The English recruited blacks into the Revolution, because to recruit them into it would have meant promising them freedom. No, this government, the Washington, Madison, Jefferson, all slave owners, they were not going to promise freedom. The British were willing to, and they did. And only after the British began to enlist blacks, only then did the Continental Army begin to slowly enlist blacks. So in asking who gains from the war, well, I have to rule out black people as gaining from the Revolutionary War. What about, now here's a group that we don't even think about in relation to the Revolutionary War. Indians, Native Americans, they're here, they live here, they're on this continent, right? Our roads in Cape Cod are named after them, right? It's their land. We Europeans have come in and gradually encroached on their land, killing them if they get in the way. Did Indians gain from the Revolutionary War? Did their situation, what was their situation? It was a tremulous one because, you know, they're these colonists on the East Coast, and the colonists want to go westward into Indian territory, and so there's a lot of tension there. And so what do Indians gain from our independence from England? Not only do they gain nothing, it's worse for them, because before the Revolutionary War, the British have set a line to the west of the colonies, roughly along the Appalachians, but they've set a line in 1763, it's called the Proclamation of 1763, and they've said, colonists cannot go beyond this line, because beyond this line, that's Indian territory. You know, it's not that the British were feeling kindly towards the Indians, they didn't want trouble, right? So it's, no, stay behind this line and don't go into Indian territory. What happens when we win the revolution? We wipe out that line. No more barrier. Now we can move westward, and we do. And in fact, the next 100 years consists of our taking over the rest of the continent and in the process massacring Indian tribes, driving them into a smaller and smaller part of the continent. No, Indians are not gaining from the Revolutionary War. These are people, aren't they? They're just like white colonists who can celebrate independence. Black people are people, Indians are people. Shouldn't they be considered when you count up the cost and when you look at the balance sheet? Working people, poor people. Were poor people the beneficiaries of the Revolutionary War? Did poor people rush to join Washington's army? No, they did not. There had to be conscription. And the rich could get out of conscription by paying a certain sum of money. This was a precedent which was set and which was then followed in the Civil War. Poor white people were not anxious to join the army. However, they were made promises. Oh, we'll give you some land. It's like, we'll give you a GI Bill of Rights. We'll give you some land. Your status will go up. Not only that, in the Army, if you're in the Army, you'll get paid and your life now is not that great. Well, you know, the usual situation. You join the military, and if your life up to this point has not been a very satisfying one, been a young guy and you don't know what your future brings, yeah, join the military. You'll get a uniform, you'll get a gun, you'll get some status. You might win some medals if you stay alive and come out of the war intact. You'll get a little land. Wasn't it? So poor people did not simply flock to the revolutionary banner thinking that, oh, this is a war for us. They had very personal reasons, and many of them did not join. And when they did join the army, Washington's army, and they discovered that they were not being treated well, they discovered that the officers in the army, who came mostly from the upper classes, the officers in the army were getting fine clothes and shoes and good food, and they were getting salaries that were being paid. The GIs were not getting good clothes, not getting shoes, not getting good food, not getting paid. As a result, there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army. Now, how many of you who have studied American history in school learned that there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army? I would guess not many. I went all through, right, the education of a historian, right up to the PhD. How proud I am. All through the education of a historian, did I ever learn that there were mutinies in the Revolutionary Army? Not at all. Not a word. But there were. Thousands of soldiers mutinied, thousands. It was serious. Washington had to deal with it. He could, and there were too many to suppress, so he made concessions, in order to appease them and stop the mutiny. That was the mutiny of the Pennsylvania Line, as it was called. Shortly after that, the concessions were made, many of which were not followed through on, as usually happens when promises are made and they're not fulfilled. But shortly after the mutiny in the Pennsylvania Line, there was a mutiny in the New Jersey Line. A smaller mutiny, not thousands, hundreds. Washington said, well, we can deal with this. We don't have to make concessions here. We will execute the leaders of this mutiny. And Washington ordered the execution of the leaders of the mutiny. They were taken out and shot, and their fellow mutineers were given orders to shoot them. Don't learn about this. All of this is to say that the Revolutionary War, like all wars, was a class war. You're not supposed to say things like that. You're not supposed to bring up the issue of class when you're dealing with war. War is, we're all in it together. We're all one class. We're all in one patriotic body. No. Wars affect different classes differently. Wars affect the rich and the poor differently. The benefits are not allocated equally to rich and poor from a war that's won. And in fact, when these working people, farmers, come back from the war to take up their little plots of land which are given to them, what do they find? They find that they're being treated like heroes and they're being thanked for the service they gave in the Revolutionary War? Hardly. Now they're going to be taxed on that land, taxed in such a way that they can't even pay those taxes. And then when they can't pay the taxes, their land, their farms, their livestock are going to be taken away from them. That's what leads to Shays' Rebellion. Right? That's something people learn about, right? Especially in Massachusetts, I think. At least they learn that it's something on a multiple choice test. Shay's Rebellion, oh yeah. Shay's Rebellion was serious. Shay's Rebellion with thousands of farmers in those towns in western Massachusetts surrounding the courthouses, not allowing the auctions to go on. An army had to be brought out to suppress them, an army financed by the rich merchants of Boston. It was crushed, but it was a sign, and for us looking back, a sign to us of, hey, what was this war fought for, and for whom was it fought, and who benefited from it, and who was betrayed by it? Working people were betrayed. And they'd seen their brothers and friends die in that war, and now they were being betrayed. The Shay's Rebellion takes place in 1786. Many of you know the date 1787, because that's the date of the Constitutional Convention. That's the date when the 55 men gather in Philadelphia, mostly rich white men, really, gather a representative group, you might say, as representative as our Congress and Senate are today. Yeah. 1987, they gather in Philadelphia and they draw up a constitution. Why do they draw up a constitution? Well, I know what I learned in school, and I'll bet they're still teaching at school. We had a weak central government. We needed a strong central government. So we had a constitution. We created a constitution to give us a strong central government. We can be proud, because we want our government to be strong. Well, it's true that a strong central government was set up. For what reason? Well, if you want to know the reason for the strong central government being set up, look at the correspondence that went back and forth among the founding fathers after Shay's Rebellion. Shay's Rebellion worried them. It was, by the way, it was not only taking place in Massachusetts, although we in Massachusetts, we learned about Shay's Rebellion. There were similar rebellions in other states of farmers. Founding fathers were worried about that. One of them, General Henry Knox of Massachusetts, I'm always proud of people from Massachusetts, especially if they're generals. And Henry Knox, one of Washington's colleagues in the army, after Shay's Rebellion, he wrote to Washington, and he said something like this. I can't actually reproduce his elegant language. You know, these founding fathers, they spoke, wrote very elegantly. You compare, really, whatever you can say about them, they knew how to use the English language. Compare them to our congressmen and senators today. really. But so Knox writes to George Washington after Shay's Rebellion, and he says, and I'll paraphrase in our own crude 21st century language, he says, you know, these people, there was these people, these people who fought in the Revolution, they think that because we won the war that they are entitled to an equal share of the wealth of this country. No. The Constitutional Convention is convened in the shadow of Shay's Rebellion and with the fear of future rebellions. A strong central government was set up not just because, oh, it's nice to have a strong central government. The strong central government was set up so you could have a government strong enough to suppress rebellion, to suppress working class rebellions, to suppress slave rebellions, to protect settlers and expansionists who move into Indian territory, a government that can raise an army. Yeah. So, you know, before you simply rush, say, wow, how good to have a strong central government. Strong for what? For what reason was that strength created? So I introduced these elements that we don't usually think about when we think about the Revolutionary War, rah-rah, Bunker Hill, just to make us think more complicated ways about so-called good wars and to ask who benefits from them and who doesn't benefit from them and what is the cost to human cost of the war. Yeah, let's take all of this into consideration and let's put that on the balance sheet. Yes, and let's acknowledge on the good side of the, yeah, we win independence from England, okay. But let's have an honest look at that balance sheet and then ask, should we have fought a war for that, given what we know about the results of the war, the benefits of the war, the class character of the war, the casualties of the war? Well, of course, the question comes up, yeah, but don't you want us to have independence from England? Well, that raises another question, a question that can be raised about all the good wars, and it will come up. If it doesn't come up, I'll bring it up. And that is, could we have put something good on the positive side of the balance sheet without that human cost? In other words, could we have won independence from England in a different way? We generally don't think of that. That is, when you have fought a war and you've won something, independence from England, end of slavery, Hitler defeated, when you've fought a war and you've seen certain results, it embeds in you the idea that this was the only way it could have done. This very important thing to think about, and that is that if something has happened in history, if a certain scenario has unfolded in a certain way in history, we assume that that's the only way it could have unfolded. Because if we did assume that, we'd have to use our imagination and try to imagine something that didn't happen. If something happened, it has a reality, has a strength. If something didn't happen, if it's only a possibility, well, then we have to use our imagination. We have to use our imagination. Could independence from England have been won without that human cost and with different kind of results for different classes of people? Is that possible? It's worth thinking about. Didn't Canada get independence from England? Pretty much, right? Did they fight a bloody Revolutionary War? Granted, every situation is different and can't simply plaster one, but still, it's worth thinking about. Is it possible that the struggle against England could have gone on in different ways without Valley Forge and without Bunker Hill and without the Battle of Saratoga and without 2.5 million people dead? I insist on using that figure to bring us closer to reality. Is it possible that might have won independence some other way? Have to use our imagination. That's hard. Have to imagine something that didn't happen, as opposed to accepting something that did happen. But I insist that we have to do that. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with history. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with doing the same thing over and over again, because this is the only way it can be done. A year before, and here's just a little historical bit of evidence to just throw into the hopper. A year before Lexington and Concord, in other words, a year before the fighting began against England, farmers in western Massachusetts, all over the western Massachusetts, had driven out the British officials from the seats of government, the judges and the local officials, and had taken over much of western Massachusetts. And remember, at that time, you know, Boston, the city, was a very small percentage of the Massachusetts population. 90% of the people of Massachusetts lived out in the country. In those places in the country, the British were driven out without a war. They were driven out by huge numbers of people that gathered and made it impossible for them to continue. I mean, there's a book been written about that, a book which hadn't gotten a lot of attention, because very often books that tell the truth do not get a lot of attention. They tell you things you don't want to hear. A book by a man named Ray Raphael, who he wrote a book actually called The People's History of the American Revolution. People's History of the American Revolution, I recommend it, naturally. But he also wrote another book called The First American Revolution, and it's about those events that take place before Lexington and Concord, in which people, non-violently, without, that is, without a war, take over. And so you wonder, at least makes you wonder, was it, could have been possible without a war for the colonists to resist England, to build up an underground, to wage a kind of guerrilla warfare, to make it impossible for the British to govern without a war? And after all, when a place becomes impossible to govern, even imperial powers retreat from them. They can't control the situation, and so they leave. It's worth thinking about. So much for that holy war. The Civil War. Well, on the plus side, right, the balance sheet, slavery. I mean, you can't deny that. The Civil War is fought and slavery is ended. But even while not forgetting that, I mean, that is very, very important. While not forgetting that, it's worthwhile at least looking at the other side of the balance sheet. 600,000 dead in the Civil War. I mean, how many people knew those figures? Most people haven't even thought about it. They know it's a bloody war, okay, but people haven't thought 600,000. In a population of 30 million, 600,000 today would mean we fought a civil war in which 5 million people died. What if we wanted to end racial segregation? Well, or maybe even slavery. Should we fight a war in which 5 million people die in order to end slavery? Now, of course, we want slavery to end. But is this the only way it could have been done with a war that takes 600,000 lives? There are countries in other parts of the world and in the Western Hemisphere that did away with slavery and without a bloody war. All over Latin America and the West Indies. It's worth thinking about. It's not that we want to retain slavery. No, we do want to end slavery. But again, have to let our imaginations go. Is it possible slavery might have been ended some other way? Maybe it would have taken longer. This is a very important factor. If you want to avoid horrendous violence and accomplish something, you may have to wait longer. The nice thing about violence, it's fast. You want to accomplish something fast, violence will do it. But very often you can accomplish the same thing without violence if you have a more orchestrated plan of not submission, not appeasement, not giving in, not allowing the status quo to go on, but gradually eroding the status quo. Think of South Africa. The African National Congress, which was, you know, represented the black population of South Africa, the African National Congress could have, they're facing apartheid, which is a kind of slavery, certainly, not far from slavery, apartheid. The majority of the population in South Africa, they could afford a bloody, they could have gotten arms from the outside. They had friends and sympathizers, and they could have instigated an armed rebellion to overthrow the apartheid regime. And they would have won, probably won. How long would it take? Maybe a couple of years, who knows, 2, 3, 4, we don't know exactly. How many people would die in the course of that struggle? Oh, we don't know, 1 million, 2 million, most of them black, right? But at the end of it, apartheid would be over. And people would say, that's the only way it could have been done. Just as they say about the Revolutionary War, that's the only way we could have won independence. About the Civil War, that's the only way we could have ended slavery. By the way, just a footnote about ending slavery after the Civil War. We did not really end slavery. It's not simply, oh, they were slaves and now they're free, though they weren't free. They were put back into serfdom, not slavery, but serfdom after the Civil War. They were left without resources. And they had to go back and work now for the same plantation owners that they were enslaved by, now that, but with the same kinds of restrictions on them because they had no resources. So this to say slavery was ended, not quite true. And as you know, black people then went through 100 years after the supposed end of slavery and after the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments were passed to the Constitution promising racial equality, so on. For 100 years after the supposed end of slavery, black people are segregated and live as second-class human beings. So while on a positive side you say, oh, we ended slavery, well, you have to put quotation marks around end of slavery. Not quite. So, yeah, these are things worth considering. I'll go quickly to World War II, to the next holy war. Every one of these, of course, there's a lot more to be said about each one of these situations, but World War II is especially difficult because, for one thing, it's in our time. You know, if not us, it's our fathers and or grandfathers. You know, that is, we know people who were in World War II. And I was in World War II. I almost forgot. And I volunteered for the Air Force. I was an enthusiastic bombardier. I went over and I bombed cities in Europe, Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, France, the good war. Fascism. Why did I enlist? Fascism, right? What could be more obvious than the need to defeat fascism? And what more ugly phenomenon is there in the world than fascism, Nazism, and all of that? So yes, that's why I enlisted. And that's why, once I enlisted, I didn't question anything. Because this is the way things are. It's an interesting psychological trick that's played upon us, or that we play upon ourselves. And that is, once you make a decision that you are the good guys and they are the bad guys, in other words, once you've settled the moral issue about right and wrong, it's settled. You don't have to think about it anymore. From that point on, anything you do is okay. You don't question it. You're the good guys, they're the bad guys. Now you could kill them all. You could kill people who have nothing to do with the bad guys. You could kill 600,000 civilians in Germany. Who are these civilians? They're not all Nazis. They're like Americans during the Vietnam War, right? Kill another 600,000 civilians in Japan. But we don't question that. It's a good war. It's the right thing. They're the bad. We're good. Very important to stop at every inch along the way of a historical event and ask questions again and again. What are you doing and why are you doing this? Because otherwise you will be, as General Groves said about Harry Truman and the dropping of the bomb, you'd be like a little boy on a toboggan going down the hill, can't stop. But after the war, I began to think about the war. Not that I had different thoughts about fascism. No, fascism is still evil and it's good to get rid of fascism, but 50 million people died in World War II. That has to be put on one side of the balance sheet. Okay, on the other side of the balance sheet, Hitler is gone. Mussolini is gone. Japanese military junta is gone. But is fascism gone? Have we, you know, when I was discharged from the Air Force, I got this letter from General Marshall. He was a general over all the generals. And a letter of congratulation, personal letter, of course, to me. To me and 16 million others, you know. Congratulations, you know, you have played a part and we have won this war and it will be a new world. Well, No, it wasn't a new world. Hasn't been a new world. I mean, it's, you know, like asking questions. Did we really free the slaves? And 50 million people are dead. Isn't it at least worth asking the question? Could fascism, and granted, we don't want to submit to fascism, we don't want countries to take over other countries, and et cetera, et cetera. We don't want any of that. We'd like to do something about fascism. But is it possible that we did something about it in the crudest possible way? That is, with war, which is the crudest way you can deal with any problem, the most unfocused, bluntest, undifferentiated act of violence, a series of acts of violence. Is it possible we could have found other ways to deal with Hitler and fascism? Not appeasement, you know, oh wow, he mustn't have appeasement, of course not. But in between total war and appeasement, couldn't there be 100 other possibilities of resistance, of guerrilla warfare, of sabotage, of something that would take longer, granted. War, you can get rid of Hitler in 5 years. How long did it take? Yeah, something like that. But what if you had a different plan and a different scenario? Is it possible that you could have defeated fascism by a more sophisticated set of responses of resistance, which would not involve the crudity of war in which both sides become monsters? Because that's what happens in war. In war, they're the monsters, and then you become monsters. In war, both sides become monsters. The Japanese commit atrocities, we commit atrocities. The Germans bomb civilian populations, we bomb civilian populations. That's what war does. War poisons everybody who engages in it. And at the end of it, you've won something, but then when you look carefully at it, what have you won? And how long does it last? And shouldn't you consider, even though it's very hard to use your imagination and to consider that there might have been other scenarios, shouldn't you at least begin to think about it? Because if you don't begin to think about it, you'll be stuck in this very common cultural acceptance of war as the way to solve things. And then the next president who comes along and says, and he could be a Democrat as well as a Republican, because Democrats have as good a record of going to war as Republicans. The next president comes along and says, something has happened here in this part of the world, or an explosion has taken place in Philadelphia, or something has happened and we've got to go to war. And you don't even think about it. Yeah, that's the way to go. But 9/11 has taken place. Invade Afghanistan. Bomb Afghanistan. Anybody stop and think, what is that going to do? How will that change things? Will that do away with terrorism in the world? So I'm suggesting that we have to at least begin to question these so-called good wars, because we want, I think, to reach a situation in the world where war is not acceptable, no matter what reason is given you. Not acceptable. War in our time is always a war against innocent people, especially children. But no matter what the objective, however noble the objective, or get rid of this tyrant, or stop this aggression, whatever the good reason is on the good side of the ledger, on the bad side of the ledger will be huge numbers of innocent people will die, and a large number of them children. And the world will be poisoned once again with the germ of war, and we'll continue our addiction to war. That's another thing to think about. War is addictive, and the more shots you take of it, the more addicted you become. And we have to break our habit. Thank you.
July 4th is held up as a day to celebrate the struggle for freedom and independence. But the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, himself a former slave and the editor of the abolitionist newspaper, the North Star, dared to challenge the exaltation of the holiday. Here is part of his address to the Rochester, New York Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in 1852.
Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, he who could address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before any assembly more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. A feeling has crept over me quite unfavorable to the exercise of my limited powers of speech. The papers and placards say that I am to deliver a 4th of July oration. This certainly sounds large and out of the common way for me. It is true that I've often had the privilege to speak in this beautiful hall and to address many who now honor me with their presence. But neither their familiar faces nor the perfect gauge I think I have of Corinthian Hall seems to free me from embarrassment. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I asked to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, and prosperity bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is the 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth more guilty of practices so shocking and bloody as are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you've found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without rival.